Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the My Imaginary University podcast. I'm Paul Grotrix, and this episode of the podcast stars Professor Sir Chris Husbands, latterly Vice-Chancellor of Sheffield Hallam University, and now Founder and Director of Higher Futures, a consultancy, strategy and policy advice company. In dreaming up his imaginary university, Chris made the wise choice not to worry at all about finances, but rather focused on a set of core precepts, drawing on his own diverse experience to ensure that every part of higher education is reflected in his institution. Chris presents us with a genuinely global university which is embedded in the community and embraces cooperative and lifelong learning. It's a university of scale and based on a federal model, with its first campuses in the landmark locations of Nuneaton and Nairobi. Distinctively, students are expected to return no sooner than 10 years after graduation to undertake a fourth year of study to round off their learning journey, responding to the notion that university is wasted on the young. Education is immersive and full service from 18 onwards, and students can expect to graduate at whatever level, being able to climb every mountain. There are no single subject degrees, and all programmes are genuinely interdisciplinary, with all students also undertaking 25% of their degree in the community or in practice or research settings. Although this inevitably creates timetabling challenges, the broad-based comprehensive model is arguably a return to more traditional approaches and bears more than a passing resemblance to the California state system. The legacies of George Eliot, Ken Loach and Larry Grayson, notable Nuneaton residents, are also reflected in the offer, as the university looks to promote access, diversity, and encourage everyone to think locally and act globally. It's a bold and distinctive model for a global institution, led by academic design, and with a very benign president for life overseeing it all. I do hope you enjoy. So, welcome everyone to the latest episode in the exciting series that is My Imaginary University, in which a notable higher education figure creates an entirely fictional institution based on their own wit and intelligence and sector know-how, or not, as the case may be. Anyway, this time it's my enormous pleasure to be welcoming Sir Chris Husbands, who is many things, including, as he describes it, a recovering vice-chancellor. He was previously vice-chancellor at Sheffield Hallam University, and before that at the Institute of Education, part of UCL. And Chris and I go back a long way to time at Warwick and time at UEA before that, but I'm sure he won't hold that against me. Chris is now working as a director of Higher Futures, which is an independent consultancy which he runs, providing policy advice and guidance and consultancy to the sector. So welcome, Chris. It's great to have you with us.
Well, it's a huge privilege to be here, Paul. Thanks very much for asking me.
Yeah, so we've got the sarcasm out of the way early doors, so that's really good. So just to be clear, I've no idea what Chris is going to come up with. I've given him a brief to come up with an exciting higher education institution, but there aren't really any boundaries to this. So we'll jump straight into it and hear what Chris has come up with. What institution have you developed, Chris?
So I do. Thanks, Paul. And you say you've no idea what I'm going to say. We've known each other for so long that I'm surprised if I surprise you at all. So the first thing to say is this is an entirely imaginary institution. And since I've spent most of the last 25 years of my life trying to make budgets work in various institutions, I've, like many of the contributors to this podcast, taken the view that I don't need to worry about small things like income. My personal history plays into this a lot. I did a degree in one subject, I did a PhD in a different subject, and I built my academic career in a third subject. And I've worked in all sorts of the sector. I worked in specialist institutions, I worked in multi-faculty institutions, I worked in teaching intensive institutions, I've worked in research intensive institutions, and I've done jobs across the sector. So every bit of the sector is reflected in my imaginary university. So there are five key things about this university that I'm going to put in front of you. So the first is that we're absolutely ending the dominance of the single subject. Nobody will be admitted to this university to study a subject. They will enroll in the university. and they will pick courses once they are enrolled. It's very much the American model. There might be some rules on particular combinations, but there will be a lot of movement between disciplines. That's the first bit. There are some rules that will be associated with that. 25% of any program has got to be based on community or practice learning, and students undertaking that learning could be associated with as researchers on research projects that are being undertaken across the university. A lot of focus on cooperative and community learning. The second thing is that courses will be structured in a rather unusual way. So you will be awarded a degree after you've completed the number of credits that you'd normally undertake in 3 years. But enrolment in this university will actually entitle you, in fact, it will obligate you to a fourth year of study, which cannot be taken up within 10 years of you completing the first 3 years. This is based on the widespread assumption that university is wasted on the young. People can come back, they will come back and they will complete, call it a master's degree later in life. This is lifelong learning, absolutely embedded in the work of the university. The third thing is that this is a federal global institution. So it has a campus in the UK. We might come back to its location just a bit later. And it will also have a campus in Africa. It's not going to be, this is not an African campus owned and run by the UK university. It's a federal global institution in which they are partners and will be using immersive technologies to ensure that students in both the UK and African campuses are working together. They are collaborating. They are part of a global community. And we've got two campuses in the federal structure at the moment, but of course we'll be wanting to develop more. The next thing to say is, of course, and this won't surprise anybody, I did chair the Teaching Excellence Framework. I did chair the Higher Education Statistics Agency. Personalized data will be absolutely embedded in the work used. Now, this won't be data that is simply compiled on students. It'll be student-owned. So every student will be able to access their data on their handset in order to help them navigate their way with support through the work of the university. And finally, of course, this is an integrated FHE institution. So you can enroll in the institution and you can progress through it in a number of ways. Essentially, it's a university system. This is the California university system in microcosm. So there are research components, there are community college components, there are bachelor's and master's components. So that's it. It's a global federal university, but community embedded that builds lifelong learning and interdisciplinary learning into its every pore.
That's really interesting, Chris, and a huge amount in there, which we'll talk about a bit further. The immediate question that sprang out, I mean, I was interested in your, you come back later to do the fourth year. Did you suggest, which is, a great way of encouraging lifelong learning, but did you say that was a requirement or is merely an option?
Well, I think the word I used was obligation. I mean, the assumption will be that you come back and do it. And why wouldn't you? 10 years into your career, you come back and you undertake further study. You might say that you regretted the choices that you'd made when you were 18, and you wouldn't be the first person to do that. In fact, there's some very recent HEPI research that confirms that that's a fairly common feature, but under this imaginary university, there are lower stakes involved there because you know that sometime in your 20s or your 30s, you can come back and do some more work.
Yeah. And but presumably the chances of you making a duff selection are lower because of that compulsory multiple disciplinary choice.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And I do think there's a, needless to say, that I'm enough of a policy wonk that every single of those features, there is some policy thinking behind it. And it does, I did once try to do some work on this. When did the notion of the single subject honours degree emerge in quite the form that we've got it now? And I genuinely, it may be that one of the tens of listeners to this podcast can tell us that. But if you go back into the early 20th century, into the 19th century, people were doing a whole range of courses. They went to university and they didn't necessarily do the single subject that we now funnel people through very early on. And I think there's a lot to be said for the American model, where you're admitted to the university, and then when you're in the university, you are at that point, you're making your choices about modules. And there are combination rules, so you can't graduate with a degree in mathematics unless you've got N percentage of your credits in mathematics, and that's all reasonable. But you get greater interdisciplinary mix, greater interdisciplinary degrees in that setting.
I mean, I think you're right, and I don't know exactly when it happened, but I do know that when I was a student many decades ago, at the University of Edinburgh, there was a significant legacy there of the MA General and the BA General, which is where you accumulated a range of arts subjects and you got a general degree. And there weren't loads of people doing it, but it was part of the offer, and that obviously disappeared over time because of the dominance of the single subject. But I think ultimately, if you trace back the American model, it stems from that very traditional Scottish approach to the general degree.
Well, in practice, of course, what we've now done with even single subject degrees is to put so many other requirements in there about the sorts of attributes that we want people to build up, that it should be a smaller step for us to say, right, let's go for a pick and more of a pick and mix. I mean, I'm deliberately saying
You
Woolworths.
can't use that phrase.
I'm not going to. I haven't used it. I said I'm
Yeah,
not going to say pick and mix.
right. Excellent. But of course, no, but I mean, I think that, I mean, given that this is an imaginary university, we can set aside the inevitable timetabling nightmare that would result from this model.
Yes, and I'm enough of an institution leader to know that there will be some limits. And of course, if you look at American universities, where they do have these not quite free choices, but considerable freedom of choices, there are limits. Economics 101 can fill up, mathematics 465 rarely fills up. But thing so we put so we need to make it manageable. But in principle, and there'll be other opportunities for you to pick up that course that is very popular.
Of course, when you come back in 10 years' time.
Absolutely.
But, thinking then about the global nature of this, you talked about having initially part of the federal structure in Africa. Can you give us a sense of, the size of the UK operation and the African operation as they stand at the moment?
Well, I knew that at some point you'd be asking me some tediously practical questions about this university. So this is university, and it is a university of scale. It needs to be of sufficient scale in order to generate sufficient choice and flexibility. So I think we're talking about a university across its, at the moment, two campuses of tens of thousands of students, but not an unreasonably large university by global standards. 50, 60, 70,000 is not an unusually large university in most parts of the world.
So it's quite hefty. Is there, I mean, you're absolutely clear that this is a federal structure, so there isn't a kind of sense of dominance of the
Absolutely.
African operation from the UK. But do the I mean, there is presumably commonality, though, in terms of that degree structure and those principles that you outlined
Oh,
earlier.
absolutely. Yeah, no, the UK and African campuses are co-equal partners, and we've got enough now communications tools to make it perfectly reasonable to run a to distribute a university across, certainly across the UK and Africa. They're in the same time zone. This is not hugely problematic for us. But I want to be absolutely clear, this is not the UK campus owning the site in Africa. This is a co-equal federal university.
Okay, I think you've made that pretty clear. In what you haven't been any more specific about, I mean, Africa is a big continent, right? Given your time zone comment, I'm assuming we're talking West Africa rather than East, but.
Well, I might have made a slip there because so I'll talk about the UK location first, and
Okay.
so I grew up in a Midlands industrial town called Nuneaton, and not unusually for someone of my generation, I was the first person in my family to stay at school beyond the age of 14, first person in my family to go on to university. And university seemed a very, very long way away when I was growing up in Nuneaton. So the UK, I decided that the UK campus is in Nuneaton. And for purely alliterative purposes at the moment, the African campus is in Nairobi. So this is the imagine university in Nuneaton and Nairobi. I did at one stage think, there's elements of it because I've talked about an American model, the Nuneaton Institute of Technology, but that gives us a really unfortunate acronym. So the university, the university, the imaginary university of Nuneaton and Nairobi is where I'm currently pitching this.
Excellent, and though it gives a very clear impression of the physical locations and also the kind of characteristics I'm imagining already of the campuses, which will be in some ways quite different, bearing in mind the ambient temperatures in Nuneaton year round. I mean, you talk about ambitions to grow elsewhere. I mean, where is the next campus of the physical university?
Where is the next place beginning with N? Well,
Yeah.
that's a that's that, and I think we did do an options appraisal on Nouvelu, but decided that the business wouldn't be viable. Now, I'm just going to make my slightly more serious point here. The point of the two campuses in the relatively wealthy north and the global south is that we are educating. So the mantra in the past has always been think locally, act globally. This university thinks locally and acts globally. And because it's taking students from these two very different contexts and taking them through classes together, it is making a reality of genuine global learning. So I would want to, we'll be bringing campuses on in pairs in contrasting parts of the world. So it may be Canada and India, it may be Norway and Namibia. I'm getting my alliteration back on track there. But the serious point, and because of things I've done at various jobs when I was running the Institute of Education, when I was running Sheffield Hallam, we in both institutions, we did put students from different parts of the world together using technologies to learn together. I want to thread that into the business of the university.
Yeah, and do you anticipate physical movement as well of staff and students, or is it primarily about using technology?
It's a great question, and the short answer to that question is yes, and then the short answer to that question is no. The short so there are some things still it is desirable to do by moving students around, but I think we've all got to be increasingly aware of the of our carbon footprint, of the impact on the climate of higher education activity. So although I think there are, there will be carefully planned desirable movements between the campuses, this has got to be viable and deliverable using technology.
Okay, yeah, that's really, and that obviously helps you when you expand as well to other places. Begin with N. You said that these are going to be kind of, in a sense, kind of full service institutions from FE through to, top level research, right? Very much the kind of California state model, but slightly smaller. So, what does that actually mean in practice? Does that mean that you would expect students to come in on the ground floor, as it were, and stay with you, accepting that, there would be a 10-year gap for some?
So this is a really compelling offer. Once they are fully engaged in my imaginary university, the University of Nuneaton in Nairobi, students are not going to want to leave. So you can you the point about my full service model is that you can come in at a range of points. And I'm making a slightly serious point here. There's almost nowhere in the world that runs its post-18 system in the same way as we run it in England. And we say increasingly that there's a tertiary wind blowing in thinking on policy, but we are playing catch up. And I think that the greater fluidity and flexibility in post-18 education between what Americans would call community colleges and universities, what we call further education and universities, is just it's so important. It's almost a no-brainer. So that's what I mean, that you can come in and you can do a single module and you can go back and come off. But if you go off, you come back, remember you've got this 4-year lifelong learning entitlement to engage with the University of Nuneaton in Nairobi.
But you go beyond that though, in terms of you do have research degrees as well, and people can come
Absolutely.
and
Yeah,
do it at that level.
no, I've been sort of focusing on the undergraduate and master's experience, but we have research degrees, we've got research units, and a really important part of the pedagogy, you're quite likely, if you're an undergraduate, to find yourself deployed as a research associate on a research project, as part of your learning and part of your training in advanced skills.
Well, let's talk a bit further about that, because that seemed to me to be a kind of really novel and exciting element, right? I mean, there are many universities that do that at very small scale, but I think what you're talking about is making that integral, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there are universities at small scale. If you want to do it large scale, you have to design the university around it. And there are universities in Canada that have done that. I think the University of Waterloo has got its cooperative learning built absolutely into its curriculum design, which enables it to run very efficiently on a sort of year-round basis. So that community learning at work. So in my last gainful employment, I thought that student community learning and student volunteering was really important. And I remember saying at one executive team meeting that I thought every student should be volunteering. And one of my provost chancellors said, "Let's get this straight, Chris. You're talking about compulsory volunteering." And I said, "Well, that's more or less." And he said, "Well, that's not the point of volunteering, is it?" But you get the message that this
Yeah.
becomes built into the expectation.
But you know what you're signing up for then as well.
You
So
know what you're
it's
signing for.
yeah,
Yeah. And
yeah.
it's part of the attraction of
Yeah.
coming to this imaginary university.
Yeah, absolutely. So are there other interesting features of the classroom experience, but also the broader student experience that you'd want to highlight?
So this is deeply immersive. And I know that the increasing focus on opportunities for compressed degrees, but for me, this is about building the experience. And a lot of the learning that is going on here is based on that interaction of the knowledge that you're building up through the courses, the skills of interaction and engagement, the behaviors that are engaged, this cross-cultural experience. So it's a deeply immersive pedagogy. It's practice focused and highly reflective on practice. You'd expect me to say this as someone who chaired the Teaching Excellence Framework and has seen, I'm going to make a broad brush serious point here, just how outstanding and well thought through higher education pedagogy can be at its very, very best. So there'll be a very, very high profile centre for teaching and learning, which is really highly regarded across the university. So yes, and it will have the full range of wider student experience. So there will be, it's a residential, that each of those campuses is residential and will be doing all the things that universities do to contribute to the socialization of students as well as to their cognitive development.
Excellent, excellent. And do you? I'm just thinking again about the kind of student body. I mean, do you recruit from around the world? Are you very local to the Greater Nuneaton and Nairobi areas?
I'm really pleased you referred to Greater Nuneaton there. That's the first time that you've ever referred to it. I should have said, by the way, I just my thinking time that there are only three famous people who've come from Nuneaton, and all in different ways may be reflected in the curriculum of the university. So there's George Eliot, so there'll be a very strong centre for literature. There's Ken Loach, who grew up around the corner from my mum. And I know this is going to date me and perhaps not mean very much to many of your listeners, but Larry Grayson, the famous or infamous 1980s light entertainer. And all will obviously have their part to play in the
Very
university.
art, it makes it sound very arts focused, Chris.
Well, there will be an arts component. No, this is a full service university. It's just that. I stand to be corrected on this, but I've yet to find any famous scientists who grew up in Nuneaton.
I'm sure there will be
But in terms of your, in
some.
terms of, in ter no, let's make the serious point. I said to you that when I was growing up on the edge of a big council estate in Nuneaton, university seemed a very long way away. And threaded in to the work of this university will be access to for a really broad range of the population. And I've always taken the view, I had a very early career as a secondary school teacher before I moved into teacher education. The most successful schools are those which are genuinely comprehensive. They are academically and socially successful. I think the same applies to virtually any community. So this is a fully accessible, comprehensive university. We will be recruiting more broadly, even than the Greater Nuneaton area. Well, but
And
the key point is what we offer.
yeah, and will you be recruiting internationally? I mean, you'll be aiming to get a diverse mix from around the world as well, but
Yes.
not dependency.
Absolutely. Diverse mix, but not dependency.
Yeah. Chris, you as we pointed out, you've been vice chancellor already at two institutions. Are you planning to be the leader of this one, or is this something that you're hoping to delegate?
That's a very, very good question. I absolutely loved being a vice chancellor. And although you said that the IOE was part of UCL, it wasn't. I merged it into UCL. It was a standalone institution, and so I think that we've not talked about, and I've deliberately avoided the question about whether this is an already existing entity or a startup. And I've given you the sense of scale. So I think this is an already existing university. So it doesn't need me to start it up. It is there. It is my imaginary university. It exists. It needs a bit. It needs reshaping. And I'm very relaxed about whether I am the benign dictator or as vice chancellor, or whether I am the chair of the supervisory board. And we will need it. We will need, of course, I'm going to try and avoid saying site managers, but there'll need to be a a director of the Nuneaton campus and a director of the Nairobi campus.
Could you bear to be removed from it? I mean, supervisory role, I suppose, the equivalent the kind of chair of the governing body or something. I mean, could you bear to adopt that kind of remote status, do you
President
think?
president for life, I think, is the
Okay,
phrase.
right. Okay,
That
so
is
we are
what you're looking for.
very much in benign dictator mode then. Yeah, okay, I've got that. Well, I just going back to students because the culture of student organisation and self-organisation in the UK is different from, or distinct from many other parts of the world. Does the Nairobi campus go its own way? I mean, how do things operate from a student organisational perspective?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We've got a working group on that at the moment, and I'm not quite in a position to come out and delegated that. No, this is a university with a really strong philosophy. That I'm going to go back to my think local, act global mantra. So can the camp the different campuses go their own way? Well, they'll have different flavors and they'll have different because that'd be the food on offer will be different, but they will be shaped by the same overall philosophy and they will be shaped by the same curricular structures.
And thinking about that, local element again in a kind of civic context, then I mean this is something that's been, I know close to your heart
Absolutely,
for many
yes.
years. But what does that mean for, for Nuneaton and Nairobi then? I mean, presumably they aren't kind of fenced off ivory towers. They are integral parts of the communities in which they're
Well,
based.
no, and I'm sorry I've already said that. And again, I'm going to make this slightly serious policy point here. I think that if you're going to successfully discharge civic mission as a university, you've got to build that civic mission into the warp and weft of what you do. It can never be a bolt-on. And so when I said that 25% of each program is based on community engagement and community learning, that means that these universities are going to be incredibly visible. And the students at these universities will be they'll be undertaking volunteering. They'll be volunteer. They'll be working in local schools, in local hospitals. They'll be working across slightly more than in the local bars. They will be. They will. Although who knows? But they will be. They will be visible in the community, and being part actively of the community is really important to the ethos of the university.
Yeah, okay, absolutely got that. What about, are there any other kind of significant features? I mean, you've given us a really kind of big picture of a big multinational institution, but are there other elements of the offer which are distinctive that you need to share?
Well, I think I've tried to say that these elements of sort of program design, of community engaged pedagogy, of lifelong learning, of free flow across the post-18 structure, these shape a really, really distinctive institution. And I sort of hinted, a really distinctive university system. That's what shapes this. Now, within that, there's student life, there's student unions, there's a vibrant music scene, there's a vibrant social scene. But the core of this is that very distinctive academic design.
Yeah. Okay. Great. And are there, I mean, you talked about things that you wanted to do in a previous role, which was making volunteering compulsory, but are the things that, from your position as president for life that you would ban, that you would simply not allow?
I knew that question was coming because I've as part of my preparation for this, listened to lots of these podcasts, and the answer is no, actually. And running institutions, there were all sorts of things that really irritated me, but just because something irritates the vice chancellor or even the president for life is not a reason for banning them. In fact, irritating the vice chancellor and irritating the president for life ought to be an absolutely integral part of the university. So no, within the confines of the law and decency, nothing is banned.
Right. Okay. Well, that's very liberal of you. And I'd have expected nothing less. And finally, then this is the kind of compulsory one as well, which is about the music. I mean, every university, every great university, including those based in Nuneaton and Nairobi, need an anthem to unite people behind and to play at graduation. What song would you choose?
Well, so my first thought on this, because I did give this probably more thought than I gave to anything else in the conversation that we've had, was so I think is one of the best tracks of all time, which is David Bowie's Heroes. But the problem with that is that my graduates are going to be heroes for a lot more than just one day. Now, anybody who has ever worked with me for any length of time will know that I tend to either diffuse or sometimes even pretend to solve problems by turning them into quotations from music theatre. And I really, really thought very hard, but eventually I realised that as a result of this university experience, my graduates, well, they really would be able to climb every mountain, ford every stream, follow every rainbow till they find their dream. So it's Julie Andrews all the way.
Well, that's a fantastic and incredibly stirring song for the graduates to enjoy and take with them wherever they go in the world, and then bring it back 10 years later. Chris, that's been a fantastic exposition of a remarkable imaginary university. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
I do hope you enjoyed that episode of My Imaginary University. There'll be more along before you know it. In the meantime, you might want to listen to the sister podcast, University Registrars Talking About Stuff, in which I chat to university leaders and registrars and others like that, all about their experiences of higher education. Just Google it. Also, you may want to visit my website, wonderfulhighered.com, where you can find lots of entertaining stuff all about the strange, wonderful, and frightening world of higher education. Anyway, until the next time, thank you for listening.